KHUM is freeform independent radio from Humboldt County, California. Learn more at KHUM.com.
Google something called Coastal Currents. And it is a weekly feature in which we check in with Humboldt Baykeeper and we talk about issues that pertain to our watershed, our coastline, our beaches, our bay, and the ocean at large occasionally. And this time we're going to zoom about as far out as we have ever zoomed out on Coastal Currents, which is brought to you, by the way, by people of Cocotat, makers of fine whitewater gear and outdoor gear, and Bayside Garden Supply, makers of fine garden supply, and they are in Bayside. All right. So I don't even know where to start other than this is going to be a seriously cool episode. And what we are going to talk about is some big think Hail Mary solutions for the carbon pollution problem that the world is undergoing, okay? And by the way, if you are doubting, I don't even have anything to say to you. This is not going to appeal to you if you are a skeptic. But I would suggest you revisit that opinion if you are not a believer that the climate is changing very rapidly. And so we are in this position where we have carbon reduction. It is kind of happening. Like, California is doing a pretty good job. America is doing a pretty good job. We are not that far off of hitting, like, what do they say, pre-1990 levels. Like, you know, occasionally we'll get close to it. And that's because of natural gas, which is a different thing. How far off track are we already? Fairly far. So let's bring in, first of all, we're going to bring in from Humboldt Baykeeper. We've got Jessica Hall with us. Hey, Jessica, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. Happy New Year to you. And let's clear you in. All right, cool. Now, Jessica, you love the planet?
I do love the planet.
I love the planet. I'd like our kids to have an awesome planet and their kids and their kids and their kids. And when I had run this notion of geoengineering by you, the look on your face, I wouldn't say you went pale, but like you were just like, oh, God.
Yeah, I have to admit it's true. I have some serious reservations about us going for what on the surface sounds like a really quick fix to a long-term problem.
Yeah,
And it's a little bit of the Hollywood, you know, let's just go in there with our white knight and save the day with a really brilliant idea when we have all these institutionalized systemic problems that we're not really dealing with properly.
Yeah. So at the outset, we're going to say right now, and I think everybody as sort of part of this discussion would agree, carbon reduction, emissions reduction, sustainable energy. That's what we should be devoting 99% of the energy into, is figuring out how to, you know, keep civilization going along at a rate that does not absolutely destroy the planet and literally threaten the existence of the human race.
Well, and I would interject that we also have to be thinking about those things in ways that maintains the existing biosphere, existing biota, the existing habitat and ecosystems that are on the planet. Because a lot of our even sustainable solutions still involve turning, for example, the desert into basically a solar farm.
Yeah.
So I really want to see us be thinking about the whole ecosystem and the like all the ecological areas as having value and have a better balance in our desire to create comfort for ourselves through these energy sources without impacting other areas. Because even as we're coming up with solutions, we're still creating impacts.
Yeah, the solar farm idea to me, I mean, we're gonna get some real opinion on this here in just a sec. But that whole, I mean, we need to protect open space, and that's a simple fact. Now, one of the people who knows more about this, and basically what I know about this, I've read in weird websites, conspiracy websites, and Rolling Stones. So it's not an informed opinion. But on the phone with us right now is Dr. Ken Caldera. He is with the Carnegie Institution Department of Global Ecology at Stanford University. Welcome to Coastal Currents. Ken, how are you today?
I'm doing quite well, thanks.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too.
So,
jump in and say, yeah. I can barely hear Ken.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, my volumes are low, too, for everybody else.
Oh, okay. Well, power through it as best as you can.
Okay.
Please power through it. There's nothing I can do on this side to fix that. Now, what I would like to do real quick is again reiterate Ken, you would agree with this, right? 99% of the energy should go into carbon reduction, and what we are going to spend the next moment or five talking about is everything else.
Yeah, I would say even more of the effort should go on emissions reduction. When I said 99%, that was just the research, but deploying the energy systems gets a lot more expensive.
Absolutely. And so what we're looking at is climate change that is underway, sea level rise that is underway, acidification, it's happening. And if you are not aware of that, or you are somehow disagreeing with it, you're denying reality. So we'll move off of that. And I just want to do a quick thumbnail of some of the ideas that are being pitched that can sort of buy us a little bit of time. Ken, why don't you run down some of the ideas that are being floated in the world of geoengineering?
Yeah, before I start doing that, let me just at the outset say that I agree with everything that Jessica just said. So, you know, I think we're coming from very similar positions, but I've done some research over the last few years that at least is interesting. So what are the ideas? Well, the basic idea is that greenhouse gases prevent the Earth from cooling off, and the sun heats up the Earth. And so some people, going back as far as a half a century ago, suggested that we could offset global warming by reflecting sunlight back to space. And the most dramatic example of this was in 1991, there was a huge volcano in the Philippines known as Mount Pinatubo that put a huge amount of small particles in the stratosphere, which is the part of the atmosphere above where jets fly. And this these particles in the stratosphere reflected about 2% of the incoming sunlight back to space. And the next year, the Earth cooled by about a degree Fahrenheit. And so since that time, we and others have done computer simulations of this these type of injections of particles into the stratosphere and found that they're quite effective at cooling the Earth with relatively modest amounts. Now, there's other ideas also, like putting giant satellites in space, but that's probably not feasible this century anyway. Or people have suggested whitening clouds over the ocean or even planting whiter crops or having white roofs or floating white things on the ocean. So, but the basic idea is to reflect more sunlight back to space. So, and because the sun is what's ultimately warming the Earth, you could cause the Earth to cool that way. Now, you mentioned ocean acidification. This obviously doesn't do anything about ocean acidification or other chemical consequences of carbon dioxide emissions.
So when we talk about, and yeah, absolutely, you're right. This does not address acidification. That is another bag entirely, and a scary bag. At that, Pinatubo, when it went off, it cooled the globe, but it also reduced rainfall. Wasn't like Amazon flow the lowest it's ever been following Pinatubo?
Yeah, both the Ganges, Brahmaputra, and Amazon had the lowest flow rates ever. Now, there's sort of two issues here. I don't want to get too complicated, but the land cools off faster than the ocean. And so when you have a volcano, you know, because the land is cooler, the air tends to descend. I'm trying to say this in a quick way. But basically, when the land cools more than the ocean, it acts to prevent monsoonal circulations, because monsoons happen when the land heats up more than the ocean, and it creates an onshore breeze that brings in rainfall. And so part of the issue is that the volcano happened in 1 year, and if it kept on happening year after year, the effect would be less. But that said, there still is a tendency to reduce precipitation because sunlight, the energy from sunlight helps to evaporate water. And if you reduce the amount of sunlight on the surface of the Earth, you tend to reduce evaporation.
Now, I had read a thing, and I think we might remember, I don't know, about 2008, the UN had come out with this study showing that, like, if everybody painted their roofs white, that alone would make a substantial difference. I think if like everybody painted their roof white, it would be like turning the globe off power-wise for some like 20 years or something like that. Do you recall seeing that?
Yeah, I recall that, but I think that was exaggerated. The only around 1 or 2% of the United States is built surfaces. So if you look from a satellite from space, if you look at Google Earth, most of it is not paved or a roof. And so, you know, even if you painted all of that white, It might have helped a little bit with the urban heat island effect, the idea that cities get hot, but it's really not enough to address the global climate change issue.
Would it, if you lived in a city like Topeka or something where you had to run AC all summer, would it make a difference in that realm?
Yeah, there's a group at Lawrence Berkeley Lab called the Urban Heat Islands Group who've looked into this, and they suggest it would help. But there is another issue in that there's another movement called the Green Roofs Movement where people are trying to plant trees in cities on both the roads and the roofs. And so the question of whether it's better to have a white city or a green city is an open question. My sense is that a green city might be more pleasant to live in.
I'd agree with that. If you're just joining us again, it's Coastal Currents. We've got Dr. Ken Caldera. He's with Stanford, and he knows a thing or two about geoengineering, which I guess to put it in broad terms is the idea that we can fundamentally change the planet and how it works with regards to climate change. It's a big idea, and we've talked a little bit about roofs. We've talked a little bit about the space mirror. I'd like to go back to the space mirror, which continues to get floated. This is an idea that we would put this massive thing, like, isn't it halfway between Earth and the sun so that it would just, like, gravitationally it would stay put? Is that the idea with that?
The basic idea is that if you're within about a million miles of the Earth, things tend to fall into the Earth, and if you're closer than that to the sun, which is 93 million miles away, that things tend to fall into the sun. And so there's a area that's kind of like the top of a hill where you can position some satellites and without much energy keep it there. The problem is, just to account for the rate of greenhouse gas emissions we're doing today, you would have to build something like, I forget the exact number, but something like 15 square miles of satellite every day. And so it's really in the realm of science fiction stories and not something that we could do this century.
Now, what about the idea of, I mean, we have tons of satellites in orbit. Is there any chance that we could maybe position one over the ice caps where we could keep those from falling into the ocean?
Again, it's a matter of scale. We're talking about having to deflect something like 2% of Earth's, of the sunlight that's reaching the Earth, and the entire landmass of the continental United States is something like 2% of Earth's surface. And so we're talking about, you know, making something that's more or less the size of the United States. So it's, you know, the idea that we're going to engineer a satellite to do this. But the strange thing is that tiny little particles have lots of surface area, and if you did it with particles in the stratosphere and had sort of one fire hose worth of material injecting at any one time, that would be enough to do it. And so basically you need a fleet of planes with one plane injecting material at any one time. And when I first heard this idea, I thought it was completely crazy. And I went back to my office and talked to my colleagues, and we were running climate models saying, well, let's show that this won't work. And we put it in our climate models, and it worked quite well. And so I've been put in the sort of position of this kind of reluctant, reluctant researcher in that, you know, every time we do simulations of it in climate models, it shows that it works quite well. But I think that the long-term risks are really huge, and that I would prefer is not to see us go down this road. But you know, if climate change does end up being truly catastrophic, we might have our backs against the wall and want to do something so extreme.
So,
Ken?
Oh, Jessica, go ahead.
Oh, thanks. I just have a question for Ken. If this is anything like the contrails that you see going out of airplanes that you're describing, or?
Yeah, this would be higher than contrails. The contrails actually have a warming influence, even though they're white. The clouds and contrails have two different climate effects. One is that they reflect sunlight back to space looking from the top. But the other thing is that if you look from space and you see the ground is relatively warm and radiating a lot of heat out to space, whereas the tops of contrails are cold, and so it blocks the heat coming from the surface and shows a colder thing to space. And so contrails actually have a warming influence. And there are a lot of people who think that contrails are part of some conspiracy to affect climate, but I think there's no evidence of that.
With regards to sort of seeding the sky with this, it would not be volcano ash itself, but it would be something with a similar property. What would that look like? Would it just be planes spraying stuff, or could you affix it to, you know, transcontinental jets? What would that look like?
Well, you'd want something that flies higher than normal jets, and it would need to put in almost any kind of particle, but it has to be small enough. It has to be comparable to the wavelengths of light, which is pretty tiny. So we're talking a few tenths of a micron. And a lot of attention has focused on sulfur because that's what volcanoes put out, and you can put it out as a gas, and it will oxidize to form particles of the right size. You could put out talcum powder or almost anything, but the problem is that it's hard to keep it from clumping and to get it to disperse and all of that. And so people have focused on sulfur, but really almost any kind of particle would do the job.
And what would be the pollution effect of spraying sulfur into the sky?
Well, it would, you know, obviously nobody likes that idea. We're talking about a few percent of what comes out of power plants today. And so, I mean, there is some ocean acidification issue and acid rain issue, but it's a few percent of the current sulfur-based
acid rain. So you're saying, just as a pollutant, it's negligible?
I don't know if I go as far as negligible, but it's at least small compared to our current sulfur emissions.
Okay. So is this emerging as the best chance right now if, as you said, our backs are to the wall?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, in terms, if we're really trying to reduce overall risk, the thing to do is to transform our energy system into one that doesn't use the atmosphere as a waste dump. But I think if say the planet started having widespread famines due to heat stress of crops and things like that, that and people really felt they needed to do something quickly, I think these kinds of approaches is what would be resorted to. But you know, you have to think that if any country did this, you know, let's say China had massive droughts and heat waves and their crops were failing and they thought they could fix their climate by doing something like this, that, you know, everybody would blame them for every storm and drought and heat wave and cold wave. You know, every bit of bad weather anywhere on the planet would get blamed on whoever put up the system. And, you know, you have to think that, well, and what if it helped China's climate but hurt India's climate and India's nuclear armed? You know, so the potential for political and military conflict is reasonably high. And so I'm actually more concerned about the kind of political fallout from deploying these things more than I am of the direct environmental consequences.
But these sorts of changes, again, let's say, well, I mean, we had a worldwide drought over the summer of last year. Let's say that just continues. I mean, would not a country look at that and go, well, somebody's going to have to do something, and it's going to suck for everybody on Earth who has to, say, grow crops or something like that, but it is the least bad of options. Is there any political chance of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I'm not the soothsayer and can't foresee the future. I think that it's plausible to think that if climate change is bad enough that people might want to deploy these things, and you know, but it would be tragic if we got to that position. But
it seems like what you're also saying is that if we do it like cowboys and with rugged individualist kind of solutions, then everybody gets impacted by it. And is there anything happening internationally to collaborate beyond the very frustrating Kyoto protocols to bring everyone to the table around these issues and this research that you're doing?
Yeah, there's the Convention on Biological Diversity has discussed these issues. Also, for the ocean-based approaches, the London Protocol process has been engaging on this issue. Also, the Royal Society of the UK has run a series of meetings on governance of these issues. A lot of the people who used to work on nuclear weapons treaties have now turned their attention to these issues because I guess it's one of the few sort of big new issues in global governance. But also the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, ran a meeting in Peru last year on this issue, and we'll be covering it in the next report. So it's definitely gone from a very fringe kind of thing to something that's receiving more widespread attention. Although I would say that there's nobody but the nutters like the idea, and it's really, I think the difference is it, some people think we know already that it's so bad that we'll never want to do it, and researching it just makes it more likely to happen, so we shouldn't even do the research. And other people think, well, we don't want to do this, but at least we should do the research. And so I think the controversy is more, you know, whether we should do the research, and if so, how much, and should the research, right now, almost all the research has been inside of computers or in laboratories or on pencil, with pencil and paper, and so the question of should you do experiments outdoors is also highly controversial.
Jessica, you had mentioned cowboy-style research, and Ken Caldera, you had also talked about, like, if China just went solo on this and they built their own space mirror and put that up. There was a researcher who went up to the Arctic, I believe this was last year, and dumped like 7 tons of iron filings into the ocean. I'm sure, Ken, you've heard about that, right?
Yes. I think this was Russ George, who used to work with this company, Planktos, and trying to get the ocean to absorb more carbon dioxide from the atmosphere.
Now, the science community looked at this guy who, you know, went up, and admittedly he was in sort of an eddy, right? You know, the ocean is one ocean, but there are these sort of circular things where you can do little projects and they will remain relatively isolated for some time. And he goes in there and dumps all this algae in there with the idea of triggering an algal bloom. And the ocean isn't the ocean like the biggest carbon sink on Earth?
Well, about a quarter of what we emit each year goes into the ocean, and eventually almost everything we emit will go into the ocean.
Well, that is a good point. Single-use plastic bags, for instance. But along those lines, the scientist community and the ocean conservation community looked at this guy as like, you crossed the line, buddy. But the experiment seemed to work, did it not?
Well, there's a few things here. One is, as I mentioned before, under the London Convention, London Protocol, it's the London Anti-Dumping Treaty, there were a series of meetings, and I was an observer to these meetings for the United Nations, that that it was agreed upon that before anybody would conduct such an experiment that it would have to go through a regulatory review process, and it's up to the individual countries to develop the regulations. And apparently, Russ George went out and did this without going through any kind of review process. And so, you know, I think it establishes a bad precedent for the way people should go about doing experiments. On the other hand, you know, there's all kinds of cities putting out raw sewage into the oceans every day. So in terms of actual insult to the ocean, I think it was relatively minor. I'm not trying to use dumping of raw sewage to justify what Russ George did, but I think it was a bad precedent and hurt scientists who try to act responsibly, but I don't think it in itself had that huge an effect. So, but was it effective? It was hard to know how effective it was because it wasn't a real good controlled experiment, but even if it is effective, I question how much we want to put carbon dioxide in the ocean. One of the main things I work on is studying ocean acidification. I'm going to Australia in a month to do experiments on the Great Barrier Reef to try to see what ocean acidification is already doing to the reef. And so, I mean, to my mind, we should be trying to keep carbon out of the ocean, not trying to put carbon into the ocean.
That is an excellent point. And he was doing this with the idea that, you know, there would be some sort of, not like cap and trade, but like some sort of carbon incentive for like carbon headhunters who can go out and pull this. Because that's the other problem. We still have too much of it in the air. Even if we turned off all the carbon emissions, it's still up there. We still have to get it down somehow.
Yeah, he was trying to do two things. One, he was trying to get more carbon out of the atmosphere and into the ocean. And then he was also trying to stimulate fisheries to increase fish yields.
And again, it, like you said, it's hard to know the success of this, but is that a model that you would like to pursue?
Yeah, I mean, we've done climate model simulations of these kind of approaches, and you know, that if ocean fertilization worked as advertised, you might be able to, you know, offset something like a few percent of our emissions. And so, you know, this question of do we want to increase human encroachment on the ecosystems of the ocean to try to offset a few percent of our emissions or not, to me it doesn't seem like a good trade-off, and I'd rather have us working on lower carbon energy systems and try to reduce our impacts on ocean ecosystems. We're already sort of overfishing the oceans dramatically, and we should be backing off the oceans, not managing them even more.
Right. If you're just joining us, we are talking to Dr. Ken Caldera. He's with Stanford, and we've got Jessica Hall from Baykeeper, as always. And we're talking about geoengineering, which is the, you know, the sort of emerging field of science of band-aids for the climate crisis. We know that these are not the best ideas. We're kind of out of good options, and things don't look good politically. We've already talked about the giant space mirror, which probably too expensive. We've talked about painting your roof white, which is maybe okay for heat island effects if you're living in cities, but is not a huge solution. We've talked about algae. I want to talk about a couple other things, including crop whitening. Dr. Caldera, what do you know about crop whitening or lightening?
Yeah, so again, this is another one of those things where you could solve, solve, meaning offset a few percent of the warming by lightening crops. That, first of all, crop leaves tend to be dark for a reason, and that leaves are trying to absorb the sunlight so they could engage in photosynthesis. And so you can only lighten leaves to a certain extent before you start reducing crop yields and so on. But again, even if these efforts to plant lighter colored crops worked, it would offset a few percent of the warming caused by our greenhouse gas emissions. And so it's the kind of thing that could, you know, could do a little bit, but it can't be the focus of our work.
Are there enough little solutions to create a sort of tapestry of a larger solution?
I mean, I think whether we're talking energy systems or these geoengineering things, I don't really believe we're going to have a little patchwork mosaic of lots of little tiny solutions. I think we need to have a few things that can really scale up. If you look at what our energy needs are later this century, the global energy system will be several times larger than the energy system is today. And that's even with improvements in efficiency and so on. And so we need technologies that can be deployed at massive scale. And there are just a few things that can do that: solar, wind, nuclear. You know, nuclear is controversial. And I think with regard to these geoengineering things, if really push came to shove and you were in an emergency situation, it would be the aerosols in the stratosphere, which is what volcanoes do and we know basically works. And I think every little bit helps, but if you do a bunch of little bits, you end up with a little bit.
So, Ken, I have a question for you. And just to summarize to our listeners, you can see more about what Dr. Caldera is doing at the Department of Global Ecology website at Stanford University. That's dge.stanford.edu for those who are curious, and just look up the Ken Caldera Lab. And in there, you have an article that you describe, you basically categorize these treatments as either carbon dioxide removal models or solar radiation management strategies. And I was also Googling, because I had remembered, I read this really alarming report about methane plumes as the permafrost in Siberia has been melting, that there are these numerous methane plumes that are shooting ancient methane into the atmosphere. And some of these are 1 kilometer in diameter or more. And they talked to a person in one of these reports who basically stabilized the permafrost in his area by ironically cutting down trees. And yet tree planting is considered a really important strategy for biomass capture or storage. So I'd be interested in hearing from you what you think about these different things.
Yeah, well, this is an interesting area because everybody usually thinks that planting trees helps keep the earth cool because the trees take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and use it to make their branches and leaves and so on. But trees are also dark, And if you plant, if you had a snowy field, that snowy field reflects a lot of sunlight to space and helps keep the earth cool. And if when it snows on top of a forest, the branches and so on tend to absorb a lot of sunlight, and that warming influence of the dark branches is actually more than the cooling influence of absorbing the carbon dioxide. And so trees in snowy areas tend to have a warming influence. On the other hand, if you go to places like the Amazon, the water coming out of the leaves of trees as they transpire helps to produce clouds. And so in the tropical rainforest, the trees are actually doubly cooling in that they're helping to make white low clouds in addition to storing carbon. And so when we first published some results on this, we got some irate phone calls because people thought we were in the cahoots with the lumber companies that wanted to cut down Canadian forests. But, yeah, I mean, that's basically right, that trees in Arctic areas have a warming influence. And, but I've argued that we, you know, the purpose, sometimes we confuse why are we trying to prevent climate change. And in my mind, one of the main reasons we're trying to prevent climate change is to protect natural ecosystems. And so the idea that we would destroy natural ecosystems to try to prevent some climate change just seems completely wrongheaded. So, yes, the boreal forests do have a warming influence, but that is not should not be a reason to cut them down.
Well, we're running a little bit out of time, and we're already in sort of marathon mode here on Coastal Currents. I want to ask about that because it seems like geoengineering as a field is sort of like, you know, Civil War battlefield medicine. It's crude. Nobody exactly knows what they're doing. The research is happening, but you're still cutting off feet left and right with hacksaws and whiskey. And so to make the comparison of, like, you know, leveling an arboreal forest to keep the planet cooler, to save other forests, it just seems like we're looking at bad options.
Yeah.
And where I'm going with this is another example of, I think, smaller scale geoengineering, which is salmon farming and using hatchery salmon to keep salmon stock at sea going. And there are numerous problems with salmon. They're genetically shallow, they're kind of stupid, they don't know how to eat, they're sickly, they're just not great. Jessica, you'd agree with me on most of those, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so hatchery salmon overall vastly inferior, but we still have salmon, and that might be due to the fact that we have hatcheries. So again, it comes back to least bad options. And as a researcher in the field of geoengineering, you had said earlier that you don't really want to be in this position. I was wondering, did you ever think that you would be espousing these sort of theories?
No, I mean, as I said, we started off in this area by trying to show that, you know, in the 1970s and 80s and 90s, people had been talking but not doing any climate model simulations. And we had set out to do these simulations thinking that these things wouldn't work. And our climate model simulations indicate they would work quite well. As I said, they don't solve every problem. They don't address ocean acidification. But in terms of the basic climate problem, at least in the models, they can offset something like 90% of the temperature changes and something like 70% of the precipitation changes. So not perfect, but pretty good. And the problem is that they're cheap and easy to do. I mean, it's just a small fleet of planes. And earlier on, you had some discussion of climate skeptics and saying, oh, this is not something for climate skeptics, but for true believers. And, you know, in an unfortunate way, one of the sets of people who've embraced these things the most have been the quote-unquote climate skeptics, saying, well, we don't really believe in climate change, but even if it's real, we can just do these geoengineering approaches. And so some of the people who've embraced the model results in geoengineering are the people who trust the model results the least when it says that greenhouse gas emissions are bad.
Wait, you're saying climate deniers are picking and choosing their studies? Is that what you're getting at?
Well, I wouldn't want to.
I think it's that part of human nature that says, I've got a heart disease, I'll just take a pill instead of, I'll get some exercise and eat vegetables.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, again, we started the conversation by saying, you know, at least 99% of this effort should be devoted to carbon reduction and sort of electrifying the grid and getting off fossil fuels. But as far as these solutions go, just real briefly, I don't think I ever caught, what's the shorthand when you say, oh, I study, you know, planes that eject sulfur into the sky to keep the planet cool. What's the shorthand term for that?
Oh, I say solar geoengineering or something like this.
Solar geoengineering.
So, you know, let me just say one thing in closing. I do have to run. We're running long, I know. That, that you know, as I mentioned before, one of the things that I do is study ocean acidification, in particular its effects on coral reefs, which is the coral reefs don't affect the west coast of the U.S., but certainly ocean acidification will. And so maybe I could come on sometime and talk about that.
Yes, please. That would be fantastic.
That'd be great.
Yeah. Was there another point to that? I don't want to cut.
No, that was it.
Okay. I guess lastly, Ken Caldera, as somebody who is in the front line of a very scary field, as are you, Jessica Hall, I mean, I want to ask you, Ken, how do you sleep at night?
My personal view is that personal happiness has very little to do with intellectual facts and has to do with your genetics and your social relationships and how good your marriage is and things like that.
So the idea that I don't know if you have kids or not, but that, you know, the next generation might inherit, you know, might not be able to go backpacking in the Trinities and see the same things that we see. That doesn't trouble you on a sort of personal level?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really, frankly, extremely pessimistic about humans and our ability to cope with problems. I think we evolved as hunter-gatherers where we had to think about, you know, our families and our village and thinking in long term and storing enough nuts for the winter and thinking about big spatial distances meant worrying about the village in the next valley. And suddenly we're confronted with problems that are global in scale and where we have to think decades and centuries into the future. And I think we're just emotional makeups not designed to deal with these things. And so I'm pretty pessimistic about humans, but that somehow doesn't prevent me from being personally fairly happy.
Well, that's good to hear. Wait, no, that's terrible to hear. I mean, my gripe about the science community has always been that the science community is not the best storyteller when it comes to urgency. And part of science, like journalism, is that you don't get in the gritty. Like, you don't advocate. You just, this is what happens. You can take a look at it for yourself. You'll see it's happening. I'm done. And then they walk away. And I feel like there might need to be a little bit more, I guess, impassioned advocacy coming from, especially the climate change community. I'm not suggesting you should run to a window and stick your head out of it and start screaming.
Yeah, so two things. One is I do think there is this conflict between what you can say as a citizen or as a person and what you can say in your professional role as a scientist. And as scientists, we're about the facts and not about our values, but as citizens we are. I you know what? I have to drive my wife to the airport. I know we've run long. So,
we've run very long. Dr. Ken Caldera, it's been a true pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Okay, great.
Ken, thank you very much.
All right. Okay, bye.
All right. And that is Ken Caldera. We kept him way, way long, didn't we, Jess?
Yeah, we went over.
We've gone way over. This is the longest coastal currents in the history of the show. So I think right there is where we have to wrap it up. Jessica, I'll catch you next week. Happy New Year, okay?
Happy New Year.
All right, thanks.
All right,
bye-bye.
Bye.
That's Coastal Currents. Back in a minute.
This has been a KHUM production. For more information, check out khum.com or search KHUM in iTunes.